What I want to do now is give you a Job dream. And we won't discuss it now. It won't make sense if we discuss it now. But I just want you to hear it. And then we'll discuss it at the end of the day. The dreamer, how I got hold of this dream, the dreamer is not a client of mine. It's a client of a colleague who was seeing this fellow about the same time I was doing a seminar with our little study group here on Job. And my colleague called me and said, I have this dream. I don't understand it. Can you work it through with me? And we worked it through. And it was so clearly about Job, I asked for permission to be able to discuss it. The dream was had probably about 10 years ago. Sorry. The dreamer was talking to my colleague maybe, 5 to 10 years ago. But the dream came from 20 years prior to that. The client was in therapy with somebody else. At that time, he was a professor of theology. Now he's retired. I see an ancient throne in a dimly lighted but large hallway. On the throne sits one who looks rugged and powerful, whose name, I think, is Victor. When I first see him, I say to him, "You are the Russian." Remember, this was the time of Cold War. He gives a last laugh, which conveys the impression that I have simply stated the obvious. I now learn that in order to survive down through the centuries, he has been around for about 2,000 years. Why do we tie that into an image of God? He's been around for about 2,000 years. About every 100 years or so, he has to find a new reincarnation. This is accomplished by someone whom Victor selects drinking a potion which Victor gives him. This person then becomes the new Victor the Russian, a sinister and powerful and dreaded person. A friend of mine, whom I am unable to identify, takes the potion from Victor's hand and tries to give it to me to drink. I refuse it. He tries to force it on me, but I back away saying, "I'll never drink it." Some of the potion spills out, and Victor takes the chalice back, saying that it doesn't work anymore anyway. He then drinks it himself. Then the few people there turn to look at me and shrink back. The transition has taken place anyway, in spite of my refusal of the chalice, and my features are apparently turning into those of the Russian. I am so angry that I begin beating on my friend, who falls to the floor and is powerless to defend himself. He screams as with both hands I pummel his body in rage. The others do not dare to try to restrain me, but they do try to aid my friend. There is a doctor who, between my blows, tries to administer an anesthetic to him. I then cease hitting him and within myself try to think how the awful power in me could be held in check. I come up with the idea that if the threat of an atomic bomb were held over my head, I would be stopped. The thought itself makes it seem that such is the case, that such an A-bomb is in readiness. And I begin to accept the fact that I must now bear the consequences of being this Victor the Russian. I tie a kind of veil or turban around my head and arise reluctantly to begin my new life. We'll come back to that the other day. Let's dig into the book now. Still a slightly introductory couple of comments will occupy our attention just for the moment. If you go to Roman numeral 9 in your paperback, Answer to Job, or page 359, in the book. card back, if you've got that.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. The first thing we're going to talk about is that word lectori benevolum, which means to the kind reader. I'm going to read you what Edinger has to say about that. With this phrase, Jung, this is on page 23 of the study guide. With this phrase, Jung is asking for the indulgence of the reader whom he knows he's about to offend. He's approaching us with elaborate courtesy because he knows he's going to stir up rhinoceros-like affects, and as he tells us in another place, rhinoceroses don't like to be surprised, so they should be treated with elaborate courtesy. That's how I understand that particular phrase, to the kind reader. He's asking for our kindness in view of the offense he's about to offer. Because as soon as you begin to look honestly into the material in this book, you realize that it's going to offend almost everybody. And if you're not offended, you probably don't understand what he's saying. Either one will be offended that God contradicts the familiar God image that one cherishes in one's own religious confession or formulation. Either that, or if one is a secular rationalist, he will be offended that Jung takes so seriously the primitive anthropomorphic God image that rationalists have long since discredited. One or the other standpoint is going to be offended, and it's quite possible that a single person will be offended on at both levels at the same time. So I urge all of you to admit it, you're annoyed. Now we start into the meat. The quote underneath Lectori Benevolo, I think it's called the epigram, "I am distressed for thee, my brother." I'm going to read you again what he says. He says it so well. I don't think I could do better. Next comes the motto. In the German original of Answer to Job, this motto appears in the Latin of the Vulgate. Dulio super te frater mi. The meaning of these words is not accurately conveyed by the authorized version passage that appears in the English translation. The actual translation should read, "I grieve for you, my brother," because he's grieving over a brother's death. This isn't just a matter of being distressed. The word dolio means I grieve, I suffer a loss. The background of this quotation is highly significant. It is an utterance of David's concerning his dear friend Jonathan. Jonathan, the king, the son of King Saul, had just died in a battle with the Philistines, along with his father. So you got Saul and Jonathan, and you got David. They had both perished in the same battle. And David is singing an elegy to them in which these lines appear, "O Jonathan, in your death I am stricken. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother." 2 Samuel 1:26. Now you have to remember that this motto is directed at the kind reader, namely at us who are reading it. And Jung is saying, "I grieve for you, my brother, who is about to read this work." Let's spend a few moments examining the biblical context of these words. This one. Saul Saul was the first king of Israel. Although the spirit of Yahweh was with him at the outset, it turned negative and destroyed him. David was the second king of Israel, and the spirit of Yahweh, which had abandoned Saul, entered David, who then had a successful reign. Now, Jonathan was the son of Saul, but he was a loyal friend of David. Though David was destined to replace Saul as the king's successor. Remember that Jonathan was his beloved, loyal friend. You see, this was a moment of momentous transition between the reign of King Saul and the reign of King David. Jonathan, the son of Saul, is caught between conflicting loyalties. Loyalty as his father's son on the one hand, and to the king-to-be David on the other. But he was not able to choose wholeheartedly for David. That's the point. If he would have gone over to David's party, and he would not have been with his father during the battle with the Philistines and died with him, his residual dependence on the outworn state of being is what killed him. That makes sense? Let me read the whole thing. Jonathan, the son of Saul, remember, this is. Can't see?
Can't see it. Just a kid.
Okay. Better? So Saul is Jonathan's father, but Jonathan is David's friend. Saul is the old king, which would mean the old values. And David is the new king, which would mean the new values. In a period of cultural transition. Jonathan is attached to the old values, and that's what kills him. If he had been able to attach himself to the new values, he would have survived. And this is what Jung says, I am grieving for. I am grieving for you who are like Jonathan, who can't realize we are in a period of cultural and religious transition, and you are stuck in the old value system, and I've been busting my ass for the last 40 years to introduce a new value system. And now, at the age of 80, all I can say is, I feel sorry for you if you can't follow me. All that in that little thing. I'll read you how he puts it here. Again. Jonathan, the son of Saul, is caught between conflicting loyalties. Loyalty as his father's son, on the one hand, and to the king to be David on the other. But he was not able to choose wholeheartedly for David, for the future value system. If he had, he would have gone over to David's party, and he would not have been with his father during the battle with the Philistines and died with him. He dies. So his residual dependence on the outworn state of being is what killed him. In other words, going back to Ion, Jung feels we are at a fundamental shift in religious and cultural values going from the 20th to the 21st century. He's trying to argue for the new, and he feels sorry for the people who can't follow him. What is the main shift in values? No longer projecting the self onto a religious figure or an institution or even another person, but beginning to see the self as an inner content with then all the ramifications of that. Jung's point of view, it is time now, it is historically time now to begin withdrawing these collective projections. So his residual state, his residual dependence on the outworn state of being is what killed him. I'm going into all of this because it is relevant to the way Jung perceives those who are about to read his book. It corresponds to Jung's feeling about the contemporary world to whom he is sending this book. You see, like David, he was all alone. About 7 months before he died, he unburdened himself in a letter to a person who had sent him a book, someone he didn't know. Here are some of the things he had to say. I had to understand I was unable to make the people see what I am after. I am practically alone. There are a few who understand this and that, but almost nobody sees the whole. I have failed in my foremost task, to open people's eyes to the fact that man has a soul, and there is a buried treasure in the field, and that our religion and philosophy is in a lamentable state. Edinger continues, answer to Job is written out of that kind of lonely awareness of the importance of this shift in religious and cultural values. Okay, now paragraph 560. Let's look at the first sentence. The book of Job is a landmark in the long historical development of a divine drama. Drama. Let's try to interpret that. Jung's view is that one of the threads running through history is human beings changing perceptions of what God is. And we've gone from the matriarchy through Greece to Yahweh through the Christian God, and he feels now we are at a point where a new understanding of that image of God is imperative if we are to survive. How is that going to occur? He feels it's going to occur with in individuals. As individuals who are the object of the dark side of God, namely these evil events which provoke inside evil emotions, we'll talk more about that in a second, as they are struggling with the imagery that is activated in them through their experience of the horror, and as they are able to, and those who are able to work with this Job model, will be involved in transforming that violent image of God, which has been neglected, into a more humane image of God that fits into the totality of what we have envisioned up to now. So now is the period of history when that image of God will be reformed in a balanced mixture of opposites. What has been seen up to now has been light. What was seen in the Old Testament was an unconscious mixture of light and dark. And now the challenge is to bring the dark and the light into a conscious understanding of what that image of God is. Now, this is a little hard to grasp, I think, because on the one hand, I'm saying that we need a cultural shift. And then I just said, but all we understand is its role in the individual. I think that needs to be understood again in light of what we did in ION. Hopefully you can see now how this all starts to fit together to this particular moment in history. Some of us are reading the vision seminars of Jung, and there's a passage in there where the woman who's having these visions, they're really like hypnagogic images, is dealing with a very similar process, and one of the participants asks Jung, so this is where the woman will bring up the new symbol. And he says, not the new symbol, a new symbol. Ultimately, I think, culturally, we are aiming for a shift in the symbol. But at this period of history, all individuals can do is bring up their version of a symbol. So that each individual who wrestle with this experience will be coming up with a new transformed image of God in themselves. And I think it's Jung's hope that if enough people continue to do this individually, there will be a general shift where the A symbols merge into the symbols. But we're talking hundreds of years. So what we can do now in helping restore the integrity to our religious systems is find our version of this transformation one by one, and then perhaps, I think Jung would say, if there's a chance for the world's survival, a new religious awakening will have to occur. Because if you think, what's the only thing that ever really changes behavior on a mass scale? It's religion and war. Well, war is not an option anymore with nuclear weapons, so it's got to be religion. So where we are today is trying maybe to make a new start on the birth of the religious symbol, but by virtue of each of us finding our version of it. I say this because I don't think we have any theologians here, but when I do discuss this with them, they will say, well, Jung is just preaching a solipsistic religion. Solipsistic means isolated, and they say, but religion is a communal phenomenon, which is true. But the way we're going to get to a symbol that is valid communally is through these individuals doing their work, so that at this moment, religion apparently has to fragment into those who are willing to wrestle with this stuff inside them. Hopefully then it will later emerge into a greater collective symbol. But that's what he means by divine drama. Really, the deeper purpose of this work is, in addition to, you know, helping us understand how to work with trauma, helping us understand how we might participate in some sort of religious renewal, at least contributing our little part to it.
You actually see this process happening now with climate change, because we can't come to a global agreement on what climate change is, and so individual places are dealing with it in their particular way.
Yeah.
And slowly over time, the larger collective is coming to a larger, you know, it's now become, it's what, 10 years ago, you talked about this and you were stupid. Now if you don't talk about it, you're stupid.
Yeah.
So you begin to see the accumulation.
Yeah.
And also the other thing that's happening is different places are trying different things. And then I think probably out of that, the ones that work the best will work. And so that would be like on the individual level.
Yeah.
Different people would come up with different images, and then the one that seems to be the most workable might kind of begin to accumulate more energy.
Accumulation is the key word.
Chris, if I may.
Yeah.
Pick up on a little bit, also to get back to the religious attitude. One of the things that you said in the preface to Archetype of the Apocalypse is that you can see this in the environmental movement, that it has almost a religious characteristic to it. And what you're talking about here is, well, what you just said about religion, contributing to religious renewal. But religion, not in the sense of a formal, organized, necessarily bureaucratic infrastructure, but a personal relationship to this newman.
Yep, exactly. And what we don't know, will that lead to a new church? Will it lead to a new institution? I don't think we know, but I think what Jung says we do know is that it's a shift into religious experience of fire versus the going by the book. That we do know. How that will look, will it be another church? Will it be, who knows?
What were the outcomes, they say?
500 years, he thought, for this to occur.
Well, given the apocalyptic nature of what we hear about the environment and such, I don't know if we have 500 years to do that. And given the interconnected, electronic interconnection of the planet through the web and through transportation and such, the possibility for accelerating that change, I think, exists in a way that it didn't exist in Jung's time. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can do this in...
Maybe we can do it faster.
20 years?
I doubt it.
A generation.
I think a couple of generations. I know, people say, now, do you really think this is going to make any difference? And I say, I don't know, but I prefer to go down swinging. At least it's a start. Whether it will produce the kind of change he hoped is a question. But it's the hypothesis I am banking on.
I see the problem is being the large population is going backwards.
Right. They're totally afraid of that fire that Job went through. And they're going back to buy the book. That's why the series of Blakes were so important.
Yeah. But you talked about the self manifesting physically through synchronicity. I think that this climate change, which is a heating, which is a fire, literally it's like that divinity, like those images there, that thing that is happening to us that we can't control, and the answer in that, the only answer to that is to become a new collective. There aren't any individuals.
It might be where the pressure comes from.
And see, that's not going to go away, and it's going to push at us until we make the changes that are required. Yeah. So my personal sense is that's one of the big, if you want to know how God is manifesting now,
yeah,
it's like it's happening all over the world. Nobody will be able to escape it. Mm-hmm. You can be as fundamental as you like, but it will still show up at your door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I agree.
It's as clear an image of the thing that won't go away as any.
Okay. Thank you. A blockbuster sentence, which we need to scrutinize. Paragraph 562. Oh, before I just do that, just a quick parenthesis. Somebody asked, what's that? The study guide and links to Blake and stuff is up on my website at that point. If you want to, that's for your own edification. Here comes a sentence we need to totally understand, and it, of course, every time I read only sentences, I want to say, this is the most important sentence in the book. It's extremely important to get the practical relevance of the book, and that's at the end of paragraph 561, right before 562. And just as there is a secret tie between the wound and the weapon, so the affect corresponds to the violence of the deed that caused it. Let me try to explain that by an analogy, because it informs Jung's psychological approach, and it is hardly intuitively obvious. Let's suppose you are attacked by somebody with a branding iron and they stab you. Or let's suppose you were clubbed by somebody with a certain size club. The mark that the branding iron or the club leaves on you will be determined by the shape of the branding iron or the club. So if you wanted to find who branded you or clubbed you, you would take that image left in your skin and find the object that could have inflicted that. That's the basis of Jung's psychology on this book from here on out. What we're doing now is not looking physically at being branded or clubbed, but psychologically. And Jung's grounding point here is that the images by which your psyche responds to the trauma is an indicator of where that trauma came from. Does that make sense? The images that your psyche generates to symbolize the emotions that emerge as you endure the pain of the trauma is an indication of the factor that caused the trauma. So by looking at your response to the trauma, we get some indication of the cause of the trauma. Well, just want to make sure you understood that so far. Because the image that the psyche uses for who caused the trauma is the image of God. In other words, if you stick with somebody long enough and work at a deep enough level, you will see that what they dream of is that it's God who has caused their trauma. Give you that's how I understand this dream of Victor the Russian. The man who had that dream was physically abused. Just to give you a simple example, because that's very complicated, which we'll get wind our way to. But I was talking about this in Cincinnati, and a social worker came up to me afterwards and thanked me for what I was saying. Because she said, we had a patient in our, she works in a chronic psychiatric ward, and they had a catatonic schizophrenic patient, which is basically a diagnosis of hopeless, who started coming out of her catatonia. And they had her work with a therapist, and the overwhelming vision this catatonic schizophrenic woman had as she came out of her catatonia was that she was being beaten up by God. And as she could understand that, they didn't work with it in the way we did, but the therapist was somehow able to have an intuitive understanding. And this social worker said to me, what this therapist said to the woman is, even though you have seen evil, you are not evil. That began the woman's recovery. And she is at the point where I talked with the social worker. She was able to get out of the hospital and live in a halfway house by working through that image that who was beating her up was God. So because we see in the dreams of people who have been seriously abused, that it is God who is abusing them, Jung's then ergo is what we are looking at in these people is an image of the prevailing, ruling God. That is what is causing their wounds. Make sure you understand this. I don't have enough experience to say. Just the two that I have seen who were seriously, well, one seen this dreamer. I know the dreamer. I've gotten to know him since. And the story that was told to me from that social worker, I haven't had that much experience to say, yeah, I've seen 50 people, and in all 50. No, I've seen two, and it held there.
You mean their image of God?
Well, no. I'm just going step by step, so I just want to make sure you got that. I'm going to take a little further. What it appears to be is that the society has a particular, our society has a particular image of God, which is good. And it completely ignores the part of human nature, if you want to be a secularist, or the part of God that is evil. Now that means that that part of the human personality, or that part of God, depending on how you want to put this, operates outside of the view of consciousness. It is there and it is operative. It's just not seen, acknowledged, and symbolized.
We have the Old Testament God, which is fire and brimstone. So we do have the image of him being very.
Well, we are a Christian civilization. We are a Christian civilization. I don't mean that religiously, I mean that politically.
I mean, aren't you suggesting that we have suppressed the idea that God has the light and dark side, and that you're encouraging that we express or suppress? Don't we already have an image of it through the Old Testament?
We do, but it's not, it doesn't have any effectiveness.
Well, it's not conscious. I mean, you said that God was a pathological whatever, and whenever I read the Bible, I look at that and I go, how could anybody believe this stuff? And they do, and they see it as good. So in other words, they're looking at this pathology, but never naming it on a conscious level. They accept it. And I think that's the problem. You've got fire and brimstone all over the place, but nobody's not acknowledged your consciousness.
Well, it's not quite the point. That addresses her question. What I understand to address your question is the idea that there are dominant social values, dominant social ethics, and they have been shaped by the Christian God, not by the Jewish God. And since we live in that rational and a good-oriented value system, the other side of life and God and human nature isn't symbolized in any effective social way. The key here is what is effectively moving behavior is the ideal of rational and good. And so the other side, let's call it the dark side of God, is not symbolized, it's not recognized, and it's operating independently. And where the ideals are what we say, the dark side of God is what we live. Yeah, but what I'm trying to get across is the value system that is consciously espoused to. That's the Ten Commandments. Well, for Jews. It's all about good.
And when we we do that, we don't admit it. That's, I think, what you're saying, is we still do it, but we don't admit that we're doing it.
Yeah. All that does is give everything that is not recognized officially a free hand.
That's why a fundamentalist president can sign torture memos, basically, of who the most famous treatment of humans imagine.
There's this huge split. So that it's, now here I think you can be content with just the psychological analysis. The people who perpetrate crimes on other individuals, because that's what this is about practically. It's about those people who have endured criminal behavior and acted on them. They are acting out of all of that part of human nature which does not have official recognition. That's the best I can explain it culturally. They're carrying the collective shadow. Right. And what these people dream of that attack them is the collective shadow. So Jung's idea in recasting it back to that first sentence, the divine drama, is if the socially accepted values can begin to shift, perhaps human behavior will begin to shift. Well, the person who is living out the evil on somebody else is carrying, is acting out of that part of the psyche not symbolized by God. But when you look at the dreams that occur in them and their victims, they are their behavior is symbolized by the side of God that is not recognized officially. And I don't mean, oh yes, I admit that that exists, but that is in fact determining the values by which the society lives.
And because we brought up the shadow in prison, you know, home centers, you know, institutions rather.
Yeah.
You know, we've also got, you know, you go work with the crimes and mentally ill, and you know, these stories, you know, which we call hallucinations and delusions, but you're also a shadow.
Mm-hmm.
You have a re-elected president, too. We lock up the shadow at the lower end of the spectrum, and we let the shadow run in corporations.
Just remember, we're talking about collective shadow here.
Right, but there's an issue. See, what the delusions that we say are crazy at one level of society, we allow to actually run the show at other levels of society.
Exactly. Exactly the point. And what people dream of then, who have been the object of that violence, is that image of God which has been excluded. That's what I want you to sit with. Because then what that does to them is give them an onslaught of the part of the God image that needs to be changed. I don't know quite whether they have internalized it, whether they've been put into it, whether it is in each of us, and they have had the misfortune of having it activated. I think more of the latter. But we're just getting started. This is such a fundamental hypothesis of Jung. I really wanted to make sure you got this. Because, see, that's how he's going from the dark side of God to individuals suffering and the kind of people who have this in them to here's where we can begin to make a difference on our value system.
I think what she's talking about is in these images, one part is God and one part is Job. So on the lower end of the spectrum, those people get to play Job. At the other end of the spectrum, the other people get to play God. So the whole drama
yes.
is being played
yes.
out with all of the actors.
But what I want you to understand is why Jung makes so much of the presence of the dark side of the God image in certain people. Why he says that, and then we're going to try to develop a methodology for healing them. So does that make sense? There's a secret tie between the wound and the weapon, between the God image in the society that is disregarded and its presence in individuals who have been abused indicates that it's that God image, unknown God image in the society, which is at the back of their misery. Even though it has been enacted upon them by an individual, how the psyche symbolizes it is as a God image. That is fundamental. Just as the secret tie between the wound and the weapon, the wound would be the God image in yourself, the weapon would be the unknown God image in society. So the affect corresponds to the violence of the deed that caused it. The affect would be rage. The way that rage is symbolized is the dark side of God. And that's a mirror image of what caused the injury. It's perpetrated through an individual, but the energy that is visited upon you through that individual is symbolized by the dark side of God. So in the dream, it was Victor the Russian.
Gary, I'm wondering, my sense is that rage is the body's legitimate response to violation. And I'm wondering, when we start getting this divinity that feels like it's raging, does divinity have a desire for an outlet for humans? And when we shut that off, in other words, when our image of God, when we clearly keep large portions of God out, does that rage from that divine side come because it feels like it's not being let out? Can that be a way of seeing? In other words, because God says, you know, I want to come into manifestation, and when large groups of people say, no, you can't come here, is that what begins to mm-hmm. get, would that be the Satan part, the part that says, you
yes.
know, I want in and you're holding me out, and then
yeah.
it just erupts, blows up?
Yep. Introverts? Questions? No? Okay. Some of this now. Yes. Yes.
Is God both evil and good then?
Yes. That is certainly Jung's.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. Is that what he's saying?
That God is both evil and good. We have only allowed God to be good in the way we've symbolized him. And our colleague here has made a good point. Well, but it's a mixture of opposites in Judaism. Until you get to the Ten Commandments, and it's all good again. So that what effectively orchestrates the way we shape our values is an implicit understanding of God's good side. And now our task is to start coming to terms with reforming that image to be more true to reality, and by looking at the demands it makes on us emotionally to do so. And then how our view of life will change in that process. That's the shift from Saul to David. Okay, paragraph 564. This is going to sound familiar, but I think it's helpful to hear some of this a couple of times. I ran through this in the preview, and now we'll look at it in the text. Yahweh, Job answers Yahweh, "Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer thee? I lay my hand on my mouth. I've spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but I will not proceed further." That's taken as his recanting, his position. And 566, the interpretation of that as recanting. Jung says, just to pick up one sentence on the paragraph 566 that starts at the bottom of the page and go to the next page, and from that page come up 8 lines. The opinion that God is just is based on God's power. He cites, the comforter saying, "Is it fit to say to a king, thou art wicked, and to princes, ye are godly?" Why? Because they're powerful. So the other dimension of this is our equating power with goodness. Because something is big, it's right. That is just universal. That is one of the shifts. Well, an individual evaluation of what is good and just. And if a corporation does it, that's okay. If an individual does it, it's not okay. If we win the Super Bowl, we're a good town. If we lose the Super Bowl, we're a bad town. It goes right to the heart of every decision we make. Power is good. The stronger is better. And over to 574. How Jung now is now challenging that view of the comforters, which he feels is so typical of us, that when something bad happens, you deserved it. Or if somebody bigger does it, or a bigger group, if a large group does it, it's okay. So the voice of the individual is snuffed out. So Jung is challenging Yahweh with these words. Go to 574. Go to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines down. If Yahweh, as we would expect of a sensible human being, were really conscious of himself, he would, in view of the true facts of the case, at least have put an end to the panegyrics. Is that right? Panegyrics on his justice. But he is too unconscious to be moral. That's what Job is effectively saying, Jung feels, in the subtext. Morality presupposes consciousness. By this I do not mean to say that Yahweh is imperfect or evil, like a Gnostic demiurge. He is everything in his totality, therefore, among other things, is total justice and also its total opposite. At least this is the way he must be conceived if one is to form a unified picture of his character. We must only remember that what we have sketched is no more than an anthropomorphic picture, which is not even particularly easy to visualize. From the way the divine nature expresses itself, we can see that the individual qualities are not adequately related to one another, with the result that they fall apart into mutually contradictory acts. For instance, Yahweh regrets having created human beings, although in his omniscience he must have known all along what would happen. Yeah.
There was one thing that just struck me, go back to number five, page five.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the quote from Job, you know, the whole island, small town.
Yes.
I leave my camera on my mouth. The fact that, you know, all throughout, God and Satan were talking about laying their hand on Job, you know, I'll lay my hand, you can lay your hand on him, but don't, you know, show him, like, put your hand on him. And so they're, you know, putting their hand on.
Yeah. You know what that's called in psychoanalytic terms? Identification with the aggressor. I'm just giving you another word for what we've been talking about. That if the temptation when you have been the victim of power is to take on the point of view of the power that has victimized you. I mentioned that under different circumstances. That one woman who I worked with, whose dad used to come home and cock a .357 Magnum and put it to her head, screaming he was going to kill her, and then he would add some invectives. And, you know, a .357 Magnum will kill a grizzly bear charging you. And one day I looked out of my mind, what a bastard, and she said, oh, no, he was a lovely guy, he just had bad days. See, that's identification with the aggressor. You take on the point of view of the person who is persecuting you, and you give up your own point of view. That's what Jung is arguing against here. That because Yahweh is powerful, the temptation when you are the victim of these sort of situations is that you disidentify from your own value, and you take on the value of the person that's hurt you. Well, that at least he's mimicking, hands have been laid on him, and now the temptation is for him to treat himself the way others have treated him.
I took it differently. I took it. He was the only one able to act reflexively when he was because I do think he realized there was a point where he was blood.
Whatever it is a symbolic gesture. I think you're right there. Hard to say past that, maybe. But in any case, it did give me a chance to mention what is going on here is that we don't act in a way that we give up our value when we've been attacked. And, I just was working with a woman who was raped, and I started working with her after she dealt with the police and so on. She was seeing a female therapist for a while and then wanted to do some dream work. Her female therapist took her to the police station. The first thing the cop said was, what did you do to provoke the guy? See, that the if it's big and powerful and you are the victim, there is something wrong. And what Jung is saying is that way of looking, that's a cultural attitude based right in our view of God. Because that's how the interpretation is of Job's victimization. Job, you did something to provoke it. And the first thing you've got to know individually with somebody is to get them out of that way of thinking. Otherwise, you will not let the healing process move. And then we're taking it a step further and looking at the cultural cultural ramifications of where that point of view comes from and how this individual behavior supports it.
We're seeing that right now with the subprime mortgage. They're saying all these people who were literally abused by these large lenders, they're saying, well, we shouldn't reward people who made the bad decisions. See, they were tricked into taking a loan that they couldn't pay, and in many of them it's fraud, but those people are going to get the money. Fed's going to give them the money, but the person who lost the money, the culture says they're the one who made the mistake. Same thing. And you hear it on the radio all the time. It's perpetrating that collective issue that if you got caught and were the victim, it's your fault. You should have known this.
Okay. Now, so what are we going to do about this? That's where we go from here. You okay with the argument so far? I admit it's unconventional, but I think it does hold water. Paragraph 579. About halfway down the page, Yahweh abandons. Follow me there. Yahweh abandons his faithful servant to the evil spirit and lets him fall without compunction or pity into the abyss of physical and moral suffering. From the human point of view, Yahweh's behavior is so revolting that one has to ask oneself whether there is not a deeper motive hidden behind it. Has Yahweh some resistance against Job? I'm skipping that sentence. And then next, what does man possess that God does not have? Because of his littleness, puniness, and defenselessness against the Almighty, he possesses, as we have already suggested, a somewhat keener consciousness based on self-reflection. He must, in order to survive, always be mindful of his impotence. God has no need of this circumspection, for nowhere does he come up against the insuperable obstacle that would force him to hesitate and hence make him reflect on himself. So the healing of this now on the individual level is that the individual begins to, one, hold to his innocence and not let his consciousness be snuffed out by the power of the perpetrator or by the collective thinking that says there's something wrong with you. You have to say, I have been victimized and I am innocent. In other words, what we're doing now is we're going to apply that Job archetype to this case and see where does the healing come if we have been the victim. Now, I want to say, I probably should have read it earlier. Let me see if I can just go back real quick. What we're talking about is the, see if this makes sense, the how do you understand trauma archetypally? That makes sense if I put it that way? Introverts, does that make sense? And Ettinger gives us a really helpful paragraph, page 31. This is now putting it back to its practical use. Now, these passages bring up a fundamental question that I want you to reflect on. In dealing with psychic problems in ourselves and our patients, when is it proper to use a personalistic approach, and when is it proper to use an archetypal approach? When do the considerations that we're entertaining today apply, and when do they not apply? In other words, when is the Job archetype truly constellated, and when can that symbolism be properly applied? You see, this symbolism can be improperly applied as well. What's the distinction? When should we proceed reductively, and when should we proceed archetypally? Well, when do we say to somebody, you know, you don't deserve this, you must not take personal responsibility for this, This was unjust. As I understand healing, your job is to maintain your innocence. And our job is to work with your dreams to see how they begin to resolve this. That would be the Job archetype way. The other way would be to say, how did you set yourself up for this? And I think both are, under varying circumstances, valid. That's, I'm kind of wanting to clarify a little bit what we've already been saying and just fine-tune it a bit. Well, it's actually easier theoretically than it is practically. I think when you can see the individual has set themselves up for it. Now, I can tell you, I think all the dumb things that have happened to me in my life, I've set myself up for. So to take that approach would be to take the archetypal approach when I can see that I have done something stupid to cause my own demise and I do need personal responsibility. It would be wrong to use this because this would just be used to disavow responsibility. But when somebody is a victim or is a victim far beyond any proportion of what they might have said or done to activate a tragedy, then I think this is valid. It's a very delicate question in our work. How much responsibility do you ask an individual to take? And you can ask them to take too much, and you can ask them to take too little. And part of the art is feeling, do I go reductively here, or do I say this is not your fault? I think certainly with children, you can say this is the approach to take. Or even if you're working with adults about the traumas they have sustained in childhood, you can take this approach. With adults, I think we have to very carefully measure. I'll give you an example. A colleague told me, we almost got into a fight. There was a certain analyst who was a big shot who got caught sleeping with his clients, like 3 or 4. And he went to a seminar where he was bemoaning his fate as Job. And they all sat around saying, oh, you poor man. That's not Job. That's stupidity. And what a man like that needs to hear is, you know, you've just lost your officership. You deserve to lose it. You might say, those women that he abused might say, well, I seduced him or I shot him in the little thigh. Doesn't matter. See, that is a Job experience. You assume when you go in to see that therapist that you can trust what happened. In fact, I just talked to a woman. I was giving a dream workshop elsewhere, and a young woman about 35 came up and said, I need to talk. I've been sleeping with my therapist. And, you know, I've terminated the work, and I don't want to see him again. And I was outraged. I said, well, for God's sakes, go see somebody and report this guy and talk about it. She said, well, I did try to seduce him. Well, maybe you did, but it's his job not to be seducible. So in that case, to take responsibility, I think, would be a great mistake. So I just wanted to throw out how this is a judgment issue. Do we go with this book, or do we go with what we know from Freud and interpret more reductively? But in any case, now back to our mode. What we're trying to do now is see how do we help somebody deal with this situation of abuse. What can we expect? What should we be looking for in the dreams as we do? That will be the content of the rest of today, pretty much. We'll go for about maybe 5 more minutes. We'll take a nice long lunch break. You probably want to drive somewhere. Do people bring lunches or? So, yeah, we'll stop at 10 of and then we'll start at 1. How's that?
Gary, thank you. point you're making about being responsible.
Yes.
Isn't that part of what this, part of some of this whole goal thing is? About trying to sort out and become more conscious of exactly how responsible you are as an individual? Because this is kind of at the beginning when Job all sits there, even though he's going by the book, isn't he personally claiming a lot more responsibility for his good luck than really belongs to him? And isn't part of this thing with Job, you know, when Job shifts this, whether when God says this, you know, I created all of these other things, isn't part of it, as the ego, does the ego get more responsible than it should be and it has to let go of some and then recognize, take an example, what's just beginning to happen to me? My ego has been trying to keep me safe for years and it's been traumatizing. And I'm finally realizing it's not my ego's job to be trying to keep me safe. That's part that belongs to divinity. So it's kind of like in some of this issue that the ego has taken on some of what belongs to divinity, and it's all got to be sorted out in a clearer way.
I think in your case, yes.
But I mean, that's part of what this whole Job thing is what belongs to God, what belongs to the human, and isn't part of this problem that it's all mixed up?
Yeah, with Job, let's say with Job, because I'm more familiar with Job. Jung at least rejects in understanding that Job did anything to bring this on.
No, but wasn't he claiming his good luck more than it belonged to him?
Yeah, he was, but from Jung's point of view, that's irrelevant to understanding what happens. Because magnitude of the harm is so out of proportion to the human vanity that we see.
Well, wasn't maybe his good luck out of proportion to what he's done too?
But I don't think that's the point. The point is, when do you feel that something is going on beyond the cause of the ego?
Oh.
It might be God calling.
I'm concerned. William Gregory? Is there a William Gregory here? No, this is a Jung group. God was calling
them
to the wrong place.
this might be a place to stop. Well, we don't have to get it all completed. No. We're going to skip some of that. And what I really want to get clear is, what now does it look like to start to heal from this thing? We get through that, I'll be happy. We only have so many hours. But I think if you don't get these fundamental, I mean, how in the world would you know what we talked about from that sentence, in a couple of sentences? But editor somehow magically understood this. And I think if you've got to see some of these fundamental assumptions, wound and wounded, not taking responsibility, how this is an archetypal approach, how it applies to individuals, what it looks like to be wounded, how it looks to be unwounded, and then what that means for us societally. That, to me, is the meat of this text. So we got... I think we got through page 579, right? Or paragraph 579.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll meet back here at 1, and we'll keep plugging on.